Real-world evidence is becoming central to the approval and reimbursement of rare diseases. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. I'm joined today by three guests. Susan Goodlow and Mike D'Ambrosio are VPs from Syneos Health in real-world evidence late-phase clinical trials, and Ray Hummel is the head of the Rare Disease Consortium. We return for the third time to real-world evidence and rare diseases next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Ray Hummel, Susan Goodlow, Mike D'Ambrosio, welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
We're talking about the intersection between real-world evidence and rare diseases. They're words in English. They're things that go together, I guess, but I don't quite get it. Real-world evidence and rare disease. Why are those two things that really belong together?
It's an interesting question. So I think the dynamics of rare disease in itself being rare, although in some ways some people would say not as rare as we think. Typically, when we're looking at the development cycle of these assets going through, it's not uncommon. I think we would all agree that there's small samples of patients where the data has been collected and the initial approval has been granted. Now, of course, despite being a rare population or a smaller population, if you would, it's still critically important to try and understand the behavior of those products once they're in a real-world setting. Okay, we're not in a controlled environment anymore. There's holistic care usually around these rare disease patients. The characteristics are often very different. And I think it's critically important also because when we think about the value of these products, and when we're talking about value, Jeff, we're talking about how much does it cost a patient to receive these therapies. And if we think perhaps about cell gene therapies as an extreme example, when we're talking millions of dollars in some instances, of course, HTAs and payers want specifically to understand, is there value there to reimburse these products? So collecting real-world data, real-world evidence in this situation is absolutely critical, really just to access to the product on an ongoing basis, but also the reimbursement status. So that would be, I think, the critical reason why there's a natural intersection between real-world evidence and rare disease.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. That's why most sponsor companies conduct registries is for the reimbursement data or post-approval effectiveness publications. There's a few different reasons that we would conduct a registry, which is really just collecting information from individuals focused around a disease or a condition. And it's evolved over time too, where now with rare disease, we will be utilizing the patient advocacy groups, the patient reported outcomes, and we could either be getting data from the patients or the caregivers. So it's really how can we collect the data to have more data than really what we could even get on case report forms.
Just to add to that, I think what we're coming into here is that we're trying to leverage as much information as we can on small patient populations. So it's not just for registration, as we're alluding to, it's also for payers. So it's really kind of a twofold group. In fact, in some instances, groups are called real-world late phase, reflecting that it typically has been used historically in the post-approval setting, but can be used earlier. And real-world data comes in the form of a lot of different things. I mean, it can come in the form of electronic health records, insurance billing and claims, disease or medication device registries, patient registries and prospective observational studies, patient reported outcomes, as Susan had just mentioned, and even biometric monitoring devices and platforms. And I'm thinking here like wearables and sensors and apps and hybrid sources and things like that. So there's a lot of information out there. We're trying to glean as much information to make a case either for A, approval, or B, payer and reimbursement. I think those are the two main things. And I think we're starting to see now in rare diseases that we not only need to, but we're being asked by the regulators to include and augment that data with more patient-centric and even caregiver-centric for children and things like that, where they may not be able to talk for themselves, or even a patient population that's vulnerable and may not be able to talk because of cognition problems, say, for example. So what we're trying to do is leverage all the data we can to either make, like I said, a registration or typically a reimbursement, or to follow up in the case of the regulators. Sometimes with these cell and gene therapies, these are relatively new. So now the regulators are asking the sponsors of these approved therapies to monitor the patients for a very long period of time, sometimes 15 years or more. So that's a long period of time to engage patients and do that. And this is a perfect tool to be able to capture that data and potentially leverage it on behalf of the sponsor, on behalf of the patients, or even learn more about the natural history of how the patient is progressing while on that medication.
For those that are not ex-US, what is an HTA? And maybe that also explains why we might think payers in the US might be different in terms of how they would think about these things.
HTA for the novice, I guess, the health technology assessments, they're looking at the body of evidence, right? Really, why is the support of the evidence to obtain both approval, but not just approval, but reimbursement across certain clinical situations? It is indeed a body of evidence. There's not really, in some cases, one specific part of evidence that will contribute towards the assessment. It's a holistic viewpoint, or at least it should be seen as a holistic viewpoint. And I think, again, going back to Ray's point, that's why it's so important to start to take a more mosaic approach to evidence generation and use of that evidence in the assessment overall of benefit versus risk.
I think Mike's spot on. One form of real-world evidence would be, say, patient registries. And I had the privilege of working with the MDA, the Muscular Dystrophy Association in the U.S., on their neuromuscular data hub when it first got up and moving. And one of the things when they started that was to try to give a framework why real-world evidence is important and the usefulness of that. And a report was generated. And one of the statements in there, just to give you a context in the United States, is that they said about 250,000 people are affected with a neuromuscular rare disease in the United States. And that costs the healthcare system around $46 billion, that's with a B, $46 billion with a B dollar. So when you look at some of the prices of some of the drugs, but you put them in the context of that and how it could alter the healthcare system and save money from the healthcare system, you have to also put this in context. RareX just came out with a figure of over 10,500 different rare diseases, unique rare diseases identified. And of course, that's a moving target because more identified each year. But with less than 5% having a disease-modifying treatment or a candidate therapy in a clinical trial, that means most people don't have treatment. So there's a lot of room to go in the rare disease world. And I think real world evidence can be a part of untangling the natural history and understanding how these patients are moving through the system, how these drugs that are being used affects the standard of care, and potentially how they could even be used in combination with other therapies as new ones are coming on all the time using different technologies as well.
Historically, the purpose of registries has been to traditionally collect data to better understand the long-term trends for specific populations, rare disease. But data collected from registries can hold great potential, and they can help make clinical trials more efficient and less expensive. So there are other reasons to conduct registries. But I also think it's very important to understand the patient's point of view, the burden that a lot of times is not thought of during a clinical trial. And another important point, too, with registries and clinical trials is the requirements and the monitoring. There's different standard operating procedures that you follow, and there's just different requirements for a registry because you're capturing standard of care versus a schedule of visits and exactly what needs to happen as defined by a protocol.
I'm going to put up a straw man of what I think a U.S. payer thinks about rare diseases. Tell me how I'm wrong, because I'm seeing less need for the U.S. payer for real-world evidence, and I may be missing something. Here's what I think the U.S. payer thinks. Rare diseases, I'm usually going to put them on formulary. Even if I don't put them on formulary, the patient is going to get them through the medical exception process. It's not there, but they're going to get it. And I'm not going to care. And I'm not going to care, basically, no matter what price it is, because there are too few patients to be a line item that I care about. So when we talk about additional real-world evidence, I don't know why that matters. Tell me how I'm wrong, if I'm wrong.
Let me give you an instance for first couple of approvals in the Duchenne muscular dystrophy space. These are done on small trials, typically less than like 20 patients. Maybe at that point, they were looking for a protein dysregulation and to see whether that was typically absent causing the disease or whether it was present, which hopefully would not cause the disease. And they made the first couple approvals, tentative approval, with the idea that later they would have to actually conduct another trial to prove that the product did work. So there was a clinical efficacy component to it as well. In the meantime, the feedback I'm hearing is some of those products were restricted to just what's being used in the clinical trial, because that's the only evidence they have in the clinical trial. So the only other way to get that data is in a real world setting, unless you conduct another trial. I think there is still a need for real world data in these instances. And there has been times, even back to Susan's point, that if you look at a drug like Soliris, it was initially restricted to use in patients with a certain disease severity, but the expanded indication was based on a disease registry data to help demonstrate effectiveness. So there is times where it has been used in there. So I do think that although some of these approvals seem to be and are controversial, I do think that you'll see a continued persistence of the regulators to confirm the data in a clinical trial setting, or additional data is going to be needed in order to keep them on the market.
The only other thing I'd add to that, Ray, is without naming products, I think if we think about the SMA and DMD space, to be honest, some of your points, I hear what you're saying, Jeff, but in saying that, I think we also cannot ignore the trend towards value-based outcomes contracting that is being heavily driven by payers now for a lot of the biotech and pharma companies. So broadly, what does it mean? That's incremental payments or reimbursements based on clinical outcomes. And if the clinical outcomes are not sustained, then the payment is not forthcoming. We see that particularly in the higher cost treatment. Cell gene therapy, I think, is clearly one of those. And of course, the only way that you can practically capture that longitudinal sustained clinical outcomes is through real-world evidence in a practical setting. Most obvious is through the registry approach, but it could potentially be through an alternative long-term follow-up model. But typically, a lot of the companies at the moment are using the rare disease registries for that approach.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of those. There are not a lot of value-based agreements out there, at least in the US, and a lot of them are seen as window dressing. They look good in the newspaper and are good press for the payer. But when we interview payers, and I'm sorry to push back on you on something like that, Mike, but that's what we hear from payers is that, oh my gosh, it's such a pain to have this data collected in the first place. And maybe that's the reason you would consider solving it for them in this way. But they also recognize that they never get paid on value-based agreements. Nobody ever gets into agreement with them unless the drug is going to work in the first place. So there are a lot of sour notes from the payer side on value-based agreements. I'm hearing you full well. And Ray, your point that there are some that made it through FDA and didn't have the clinical data, and payers started denying drugs that you would never have expected them to deny in a previous world. And that is a new world. And that's a place where it strikes me that the most value actually is with the US payer, as opposed to what potentially manufacturers think the value is. I mean, either's fine if you were trying to do work for them, but where do they actually need to have the answers? I suspect it's when they've gotten a non-approval on the formularies.
Yeah, although I'm going to pick you up also on an interesting point here, Jeff, because I think in some ways what you said resonates. Perhaps there's a hesitancy in some ways with payers or even with developers themselves to chase this valuable real-world data because it's perceived as it's too difficult. It's too difficult to collect this data on a long-term basis from patients who already have a high degree of burden. And I think that's a fair point. But I think at the same time, from our vantage point, what I can say is that regulators particularly are much more open to more innovative ways to reduce the burden, not just on the patients and caregivers, but also to reduce the burden on the treating physicians or wraparound care environment to collect said data. I mean, some good examples, Jeff, would be particularly the overlay of technologies that allow more passive collection of that data. So EHR to EDC transfers, where practically we're not asking sites to stand up valuable resources to really punch in data like it was the 80s.
That's electronic data capture and electronic health resources. So they talk to each other like a wearable talks. In my case, Duke My Health, it would get maybe my information.
Exactly. And we've seen some recent examples of the first IND approvals in that approach, where in actual fact, patient-mediated release of electronic healthcare data and then subsequent mapping back into a database, a registry-type database, has contributed towards approval of that product. I think there's the overlay, which is, I guess, more the kind of buzz at the moment, Jeff, of tokenization, particularly in the US, where we're really trying to, again, reduce in some way the burden of that practical punch in data entry and starting to piece together digital healthcare journeys for patients through linkage into secondary database sets. And that's also been a successful methodology, particularly when we're looking at that kind of longitudinal, long-term 10, 15-year period where we're having to practically collect data on that patient, but that patient themselves can be transient, right? They don't just stay in one place all the time. So I think that argument of it's too difficult now is probably old hat, Jeff. And I think, again, we're probably seeing a turning of the tide there, where it's probably, in my view now, not acceptable not to collect real-world outcomes, and particularly in that rare disease space. And I would finish it off also by saying that if we could level one thing at ourselves as an industry, it's possibly that in the past we've been too focused on those solid clinical outcomes and maybe less focused on the specific softer patient experience. And I know that Ray touched on that earlier on in our conversation. I think that's also becoming vastly important because we also need to show ultimately value to the end user, which is the patient. Is that their experience? Is it a reduced burden on their wraparound care? But also it's giving back to the community. So it's giving back to the rare disease community, the advocacy groups, to empower them also with the data. So I think we're also seeing a turning of the tide where industry is now more willing to share back that data into the community for the wider benefit of that patient segment as well as future development for therapies.
And I think it's different too in rare disease because most rare disease patients and caregivers do want to provide that data. They want to see how that data helps and they want to help other caregivers and other rare disease patients by providing that data. So you don't have the same issues you may have with another therapeutic area or patient registry. A lot of times you will hold on to the patient and continue to capture that data so that other patients understand about the rare disease. And I think it would help Ray, just because you're a caregiver, I think it helps for you, right? So if you were in a rare disease registry, you would want to provide that data.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say another thing that we're missing here that's a unique feature of the rare diseases is a lot of the companies and sponsors are targeting what I call like an ultra rare disease. So if you take a rare disease, something like limb girdle muscular dystrophy, and you look at all the different subtypes, there's at least 35 different plus subtypes, and you're only targeting one, then I would say if you're just doing 1/35th, although they're not equally distributed, but let's just say that, then that would be like an ultra rare disease. So if a company is looking for an approval in just one subset of that, then the rest of the folks who have diagnosed with limb girdle muscular dystrophy and their subtypes, they want to be treated as well. So it's a matter of trying to figure out not only for the subtypes, but then also for the payers to see, would it be applicable if, since it was only studied in a subtype, to be maybe paid for all the different subtypes? That's a question that's being asked now, even in Duchenne. If you're only using maybe a technology that's only amenable to a certain mutation or a genetic mutation, you know, would it be paid in other ones? So there's a couple of nuances in there. But I think at the end of the day, it does come back to feedback from the patients, and it can be obtained through registries and through direct feedbacks like the patient reported outcomes, as we mentioned before. People are saying, look, if I can't get a cure for my disease, what's important to me is I'm existing until that cure or that candidate therapy is approved. What can help my life be better? So people sometimes are telling me, I'm hearing feedback, things like, if you could just help my fatigue, that would make my disease better. So it's about not only the patient reported outcomes, but it's about getting feedback that's essential to trying to make these patients maybe feel better and be a lower economic burden to the healthcare system in the meantime, until we can actually get a cure for all these patients.
So if I'm to sum up where we've been and where we are, essentially at the beginning was real world evidence didn't matter. At the beginning, didn't matter for approval, didn't matter for payer experience on whether or not you got on formularies. Where we are is that real world evidence is at times extremely important for approval, could be the basis for approval, and is certainly something that you have to consider when you're getting your clinical trials done, could be a basis for getting on formulary and is important for the health technology assessment groups, ex-US. So that's where we are. Real world evidence really matters for rare diseases. Where's it going in the future? What's the future of real world evidence and rare diseases?
I think in some ways, there's also going to be more of a convergence here. I think there's potentially, in my view, going to be less of a separation between the clinical versus the commercial space of these assets. Why? Because as Ray said, I think we're chasing a lot of ultra-rare indications these days. The populations will continue to be smaller in terms of those clinical trials that are approved on. I think more and more, we're probably going to see the use of external control arms for supporting initial approval in rare disease. Why? Again, because it's not ethical to stand up control arms generally in rare disease space. And if we're thinking about the value that things like rare disease registries can bring, it's also not actually uncommon for rare disease registry data sets to be used as external comparator arms for the products intended to be approved. So I think we're going to see more of that. I think we'll see more and more the use of real-world data, particularly around registry data, for better understanding the natural history of the disease or the natural course of the disease, to try and find more optimal pivot points for where to position treatment, where is it going to be most effective. And I think overall, there's also going to be that convergence of the experience of the patient, not just within the clinical trial, but going into that 5-10 year downstream period as well. Because again, particularly when we're looking at cell gene therapies as an example, it's really one shot and you're done. It's not like a typical new chemical entity clinical trial where the patient is taking an ongoing treatment of medication. No, it's one infusion generally, and then that's it. So I think for rare disease, the genie's bottle has been opened, Jeff, and I think we're going to continue to see that it plays more and more of a dominant role in both the development as well as the approvals.
I think we'll also see in clinical trials where we start to capture more real-world data with tokenizing patients when they enter a clinical trial, to go ahead and start capturing that data early on, even with cell gene therapy, so you have it at that time point, but then in the future as well, when you open up a registry. And we do use technology more and more. Existing registry data is also used. So I do think it will continue to evolve with technology, the more data we can capture up front as far as the patient's daily life and how it changes over time with the 15-year follow-up studies or registries.
From my standpoint, I see things like the registries from 10 years ago when I sat on a couple government agencies that monitored, say, folks with muscular dystrophy. And I asked them, I said, you know, how are you collecting the data and what types of data are you collecting? Because I want to see the value of it. And they said, well, we're kind of collecting everything because we don't really know what's going to be valuable in the future. And I think we've moved away from that, and we're going to continue to move away from that to trying to get more pinpoint and targeted data, and also to validate the quality and the types of data that are being used and that have precedent with the regulators or payers. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the registries move from just collecting data to who the patients are. You're going to start seeing the interpretation of that turn into, say, natural history studies in more sophisticated ways. You're going to also see that data being mined to see where you can make an inflection point in the natural history study. So you're going to actually come up with new primary, secondary endpoints that'll be acceptable to the regulators and ultimately come up with a clinical trial ready network or an extension network or something that will be more what I call integrated drug development. So it won't just be a matter of trying to appease the regulator. It'll also be trials increasingly be used to satisfy the payers as well. And the lines are going to blur and will continue to blur because I think it's important for both entities to be satisfied.
Ray Hummel, Susan Goodlow, Mike D'Ambrosio, thanks so much for joining us on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. If you want to talk through a hard decision you're making at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. For access to more future-focused, actionable life sciences insights, visit the Syneos Health Insights Hub at insightshub.health. Syneos Health, shortening the distance from lab to life.